Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class at Crossover Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from July 6, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the three marks of existence. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. Thank you. Peace.
When the Buddha gave his very first teaching, that was called the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Sutta setting the wheel of truth in motion. In that sutta, he taught the Four Noble Truths for the first time. And upon hearing the sutta, the teaching, one of the guys that was there, his name was Kandana, understood it completely at a deep and profound level. And he said, all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. He was speaking directly to an understanding, a profound understanding of impermanence of all things in the physical world, but also, and most importantly, the impermanence of his own views of himself in relation to the world. When he made that statement, the Buddha said, you are now Anakandana, the one who understands. For most of us, it's not that easy. It takes a few more teachings, but everything that the Buddha would teach from that point on for the next 45 years was taught in the context of those Four Noble Truths. And this talk tonight on what is called the Three Marks of Existence describes the ongoing common human experience that we all have. The Three Marks of Existence are anicca, impermanence, anatta, the not-self-characteristic, and dukkha, the ongoing experience of disappointment and suffering as a consequence of having a human life. The First Noble Truth, the Buddha teaches what dukkha is. And it's very simple, it's very direct. There's nothing mystical or magical or esoteric about it. He states that birth is suffering or painful or dukkha or stressful. Sickness is stressful, aging is stressful, death is stressful. Not getting what is desired is stressful. Getting what is undesired is stressful. Then he would always conclude that statement when he's describing dukkha, describing stress, as saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful, are dukkha. The five clinging aggregates simply describe the personal experience of suffering. The five clinging aggregates are form, physical form, and then everything in the physical world. Feelings. Feelings are any disturbance in our mind. Perceptions, which are judgments attached to those feelings. Now, we have to remember that this is in the context of Four Noble Truths and in the context of ignorance. So these are feelings that are arising from ignorance. It's a self-reflected form that's part of that ignorant view. Form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications is the next aggregate of these five clinging aggregates. The simplest explanation of a fabrication is an assumption. We create assumptions about ourselves in relation to the world. Now, because those assumptions are rooted in ignorance, they're wrong assumptions, and they can only continue ignorance the more we hold on to those assumptions. Form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and the resulting, the fifth aggregate is consciousness, but it's not consciousness with a grand C. It's not a cosmic type of unified consciousness. It's simply ongoing thinking that is rooted in that initial ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So that's the five clinging aggregates. That's the experience of self. That characteristic that the Buddha used to describe that is anatta. Anatta means not self. And it simply means that the views that we've acquired rooted in ignorance do not accurately describe a self. Those are wrong views. Let go of the views. And this directly relates to the Eightfold Path, especially the first factor of right view. I'll touch on that in a little while. The third factor of that three marks of existence, impermanence, the not-self-characteristic, and the resulting dukkha, is described as that first noble truth. So because of a wrong view of who we are in relation to the impermanent world, we create stress for ourselves. We do that directly by insisting that what we are is a permanent and substantial self, and that permanent and substantial self requires constant vigilance to defend and maintain in this impermanent environment. And if you can really understand that, and this is what Kandana got when he first heard the Four Noble Truths, if you can really understand the impermanent nature of who you are and of all things, then you'll cease defending this self, because you'll realize that you're defending something that, using the Buddha's words, is like foam on the ocean. There's nothing really there. Why continue to defend something that is that impermanent, that fleeting? Let me read the Buddha's words when I'm describing impermanence. Be mindful of impermanence to end conceit. Conceit is another word for eye-making. That's what we do when we're stuck in wrong views of self. We continue to defend this thing called self. When impermanence is understood, it is also understood that none of this is self. Nothing. Often when the Buddha is describing dukkha, he talks about joining these views of self to the suffering of the world, to the things that are disappointing in the world. Creating identities of needing to get what we feel we need, creating identities of avoiding anything we think will affect our happiness. And along the way, we maintain this constant level of hypervigilance about maintaining a self, a permanent self. It can't be done. Understanding not self uproots conceit, it uproots eye-making. When fully established, release is complete. The Buddha here is describing his entire teaching in that one paragraph. If we can understand the impermanent nature of all things, then we can enter into, Buddhist lexicon, it's called being a stream enter. We can enter into the stream of our own life. We can be mindful of our life as life occurs without the need for it to be any different than it is. Why? Because we understand the impermanence of all things. So when something comes along that is disturbing to us, that we'd rather not experience, we realize that there's no me in that. We realize the impermanence of it. We can take a breath and understand that all things are impermanent, and whatever we're becoming distressed about will come to cessation. The same applies to anything that is giving us pleasure in the moment and we start attaching ourselves to. This is really the essence of compulsive behavior. It's the essence of addiction. But we don't have to have extreme forms of addiction to experience this type of compulsion, wanting to hold on tight to anything that we're using to define ourselves that gives us pleasure. And we often describe ourselves in relation to these experiences as me or mine. I like this, I don't like that. We do it with nearly everything in the world. We do it with the political situation. We do it with hobbies. We do it with preferences with other people. We do it with food substances. We do it with drugs and alcohol. We do it with common human experiences. I like this, I don't like that. That's the essence of eye-making. And all of those things are an aspect of the first mark of existence, of impermanence. Lao Tzu, the great Chinese sage that developed the I Ching, said that once we recognize the impermanence of all things, we'll let go of everything. Why hold on to anything? Why create an identity? Why create a life experience that is clinging to things that are impermanent? They're like foam on the ocean. Now, this often leads to the next question. Well, what happens when I let go of attachment to things? Because it feels like we have to be attaching ourselves to things, clinging to things, in order to maintain the things in our life, the practical things in our life, and this identity. So when we start letting go of these self-referential views, it feels like annihilation. It feels like there's going to be no me left. But what happens when we let go of all self-referential views is we develop a life of deep meaning and purpose and deep mindfulness of our life as life occurs. And then we're in the process of moving away from ignorance and towards awakening. And if we can truly understand the three marks of existence and the fleeting nature of each one of these marks, we can enter into the potential that each moment has. And the potential that each moment has is to continue to develop the Eightfold Path through deep concentration and refined mindfulness and move towards awakening. Or we can disregard all of this and continue a life rooted in ignorance and continue a life that is prone to stress. Isn't it remarkable that 2,600 years ago, the Buddha recognized the primary problem of all human beings? It seems almost insignificant until you understand how deep and pervasive stress is that dukkha is. But yet he recognized this 2,600 years ago And it's something that it's just in the last, let's say, 20 years or so, that we're coming to grips with the pervasive destructiveness of stress in our lives. We're recognizing it as one of the major medical problems of our time. But it's even more devastating than that. The preoccupation with that third mark of existence, the preoccupation with dukkha, the constant preoccupation of satisfying, attempting to satiate that which is insatiable, the self-referential ego self, that which the Buddha said is anatta, there's no such thing as a self there. The constant need for satiating that self-referential ego self distracts us from living our life as our life unfolds. And so our minds are almost always in the past or in the future, or we're ambivalent about what's occurring because it's not disturbing, it's not activating one of our senses, including that ongoing consciousness rooted in ignorance. The three marks of existence, anicca, anatta, dukkha, impermanence of the not-self characteristic and resulting suffering, is something that every human being experiences. And it's something that every human being gets trapped into. Those of you that have heard me talk about the Nagara Sutta, where the Buddha describes his awakening, there's a part of that sutta where the Buddha talks about getting stuck in a feedback loop of self-referential views and consciousness rooted in ignorance. And even as the Buddha describes it, he could not figure out a way to get out of that that feedback loop. That's the loop that we get stuck in. That's the loop of the interplay of impermanence, the not-self-characteristic, and the resulting dukkha. Another way of describing the feedback loop is being stuck in deluded views. So I've asked this question a few times, just a rhetorical question. If we're stuck in deluded views, if our thinking is deluded, how do we know it and how do we get out of it? That's something that the Buddha pondered upon his awakening. How can I teach what I know to people that are stuck in wrong views and deluded views? And that's when he came up with and developed the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path provides the framework for recognizing our thoughts, words, and deeds that are rooted in ignorance, that are producing stress because of that ignorance, a way to recognize them and to simply abandon them. So the Eightfold Path is the way to recognize these three marks of existence and to extricate ourselves from being stuck in that. And so what happens when you become awakened, when you develop the Eightfold Path? And again, the Buddha taught this path to be developed in this lifetime. And any human being could develop it. It's often portrayed as something that takes endless lifetimes and you need some kind of advanced karma. The Buddha never taught any of that. He taught a simple and direct way that we can gain control of our thinking and gain control of our lives and understand on a deep and profound level who we are in relation to the impermanent world. And when we cease joining with the world through clinging our views to the world, will cease creating stress in our lives. That's the end of tonight's talk. This article itself is linked in today's email too, if you want to read it. But I thought I'd wing it without reading it tonight. So. Thank you. Any questions about the talk? And then we'll go around the room. No, you all got it? The three marks of existence. It's one of those things that's so obvious, but it's also very, very difficult to see. And the reason why is there's a component. Now remember, the Buddha awakened, I guess I'm going to talk a little bit more. The Buddha awakened the dependent origination, which states from ignorance to 12 observable causative links, all manner of suffering arises. What he's saying is that because of ignorance, we end up at that first noble truth. And so we need something to get ourselves out of that ignorance. A component of ignorance is a mind that is stuck in ignorance to ignore anything that would challenge that ignorance. And that's where the difficulty comes. It's almost like there's this veil hiding the obviousness of the three marks of existence to ourselves. I've had a few students, mostly online because I don't have the opportunity to explain this as well in the book, that say, I get impermanence. I know everything is impermanent. And we all do. But we don't understand that we've created identities, a permanent identity that we hope we can keep separate from the impermanence of all things. And that's where all stress arises. Because remember what Lao Tzu said, if we understand the impermanence of all things, we simply will not attach ourselves to impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas. We won't create stress in our lives. Kevin, good to see you tonight. How's your practice going?
Practice is good. It's steady. Variable.
Impermanent.
And this week I've had a very distracted thinking during my meditation. And then I've had a couple of sessions where it seemed like it was a big breakthrough of non-distraction. Yes, and it was very profound and very pleasant and very awesome. But then it goes back to distraction again. I noticed today, as I was, after I meditated and I was planning my day, I had the day off and I had things to do, I felt very agitated, just very, like I haven't felt it in a long time, months. And I think it is that, you know, that self, that not self, that's probably rearing its head and saying, okay, you need these distractions. You are distracted. And I think it just is defending itself, maybe. And that's what led to the continued agitation. I'm not sure, but that's the way I was interpreting it. So I tried to let it go, but I think I let it go just to be distracted by other things. And planning to come here. And it's good to come here because it just sort of a refuge too.
Thank you for saying that. Yeah, we're fortunate to have this true refuge, and that's how the Buddha taught the three refuges, and taking a refuge in himself, and understanding that an awakened human being actually accomplished this task of awakening, and he left the teachings how to do it, the Dhamma, and we have a well-focused Sangha. You're also talking about the impermanence of Dhamma practice. Sometimes it just feels wonderful, and sometimes it feels like almost like another distraction. The Buddha refers to that in the hindrances and in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Sutta on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. Simply to be mindful that these things will occur. Not to do anything about it, recognize it, just as you described it. You recognize that it's just part of dukkha. It's part of this whole thing. What do you do? Meditate? Come to another class and you continue on. And in the end, this is another good example of a stream enter. As long as a stream enter means once you've been exposed to the Dhamma, to the Four Noble Truths, and you start developing it, you are now a stream enter. And just like a nice flowing stream, as long as you stay in the stream, you're going to get to the other end. Of course, at any point we can jump out. But as long as you maintain the stream, as long as you maintain your focus, the end is assured. The Buddha guarantees it. Develop the path wholeheartedly, and you will awaken. Thank you. Tom, good to see you again. How you been?
Good.
Yeah,
practice is going. It's going. It's been consistent as far as my meditations, twice a day.
Outstanding.
Very distracted though, and definitely one first thing you taught me is to have compassion, so I'm just kind of going with the flow, and summers are usually pretty busy for me, so possibly why I'm distracted, and that's okay.
Yeah.
But definitely realize that I have to make sure I keep reading and then coming to class too, because the Eightfold Path and all the teachings kind of go away if you don't continue to keep it in your mind, and or at least that's how it's been for me. So it just reminds me to put in the right effort, and been good. It's interesting about the impermanence. Whenever I've dealt with stress or dukkha or, you know, I'm just thinking about this, when there's an external event that happens, it's almost like I'm able to better process it because I realize that it's impermanent. But every once in a while, I get myself all worked up about a lot of stuff, and I'm just really in a bad place, or I'm a bit agitated, and I'm like, why am I upset? And it's the impermanence that really kind of makes it more, or the feeling that it's permanent,
yeah,
which makes it more stressful. Not having that realization that, well, you're just, there's a lot going on, and it's your ebb and flow that's going to, you know, of life, and it'll eventually, it's going to go away, but it's almost like the feeling that it's permanent makes it worse. So when I recognize that and I say it's impermanent, it's going to go away, whatever you're dealing with in this moment, you know, 5 minutes from now, you may be distracted and you'll be in a better spot. So that was just kind of my thoughts on impermanence. That's all I
have. Thank you. I mean, that's the experience of wanting something to be different than it is. An awakened mind, and the Buddha described that mind as a mind of calm, a mind of equanimity, means that whatever is occurring is simply what's occurring. It can't be any different than it is. We also learn an understanding of the difference between acceptance and approval. We don't have to approve of something, but if we're going to have a peaceful mind, we accept it because it's what's occurring. We don't have any I in it. You know, I don't need anything to be any different than it is. Again, it could be something that is quite painful or horrible, you know. It could be something that is incredibly exciting. If we can keep me out of it, keep the I-making out of it, recognizing that no matter what it is, I don't have to build an identity over it, then we can maintain peace. But you're describing it from that other point of view, from joining with this, with the upset, you know, and wanting it to be different. All things are impermanent. Why hold on to anything? Meditation deepens concentration, but it's the Eightfold Path, or integrating the Eightfold Path, that allows us to really understand the distraction of continued eye-making, of continued conceit. That's why the Buddha didn't teach just meditation. He didn't just say, go sit a couple times a day and people, you're all good to go. He taught this path to be developed so that we could recognize the self-referential views, these views that are causing us to create a self in everything that occurs and causes stress. So, thank you. Glad you're here tonight. Lorna, good to see you.
Good to see you, John. And everybody. Sometimes when I'm meditating, I get to the point where I'm just thinking about my breath. And sometimes in meetings with Sangha members, that they talk about the thoughts breaking through, the thoughts breaking through, the thoughts breaking through. Sometimes I get my breath breaking through, and it's just like I just lock onto the breath, and it's just there, one breath after another, breath after another, and it's like my breath breaks through my thoughts. Another way to kind of describe it is that if you're out in the middle of an ocean and there's on a sort of rubber dinghy, the boat would be to and fro. You wouldn't have to look over your shoulder to see if there's another wave coming. You would just know there is. You would just know it. It's like that. It's just that I just know that I'm focused on my breath and that the thoughts have subsided, and my breath has kind of broken through, and I'm just riding my breath, just like being on a wave, out to sea, just riding the waves. So I guess that's when I have, you know, no anatta thoughts, because when thoughts are breaking through my meditation, I can definitely relate them back to anatta, that I'm still wanting to trace them back to Hong Kong. And then I think I've observed just lately that a few weeks or say said, you know, I observe the rising, but I don't observe the passing away in life. I think I'm just beginning to change on that. I think I've realized the passing away also. And I think the passing away is the gateway to seeing impermanence. And I think that's kind of a bit of a breakthrough. Just to see the arising and the passing away of phenomena, is it the word?
Yeah.
And that's really the gateway to understanding impermanence and seeing impermanence in action.
Yeah.
And seeing it.
Recognizing the arising and the passing away of all things is understanding impermanence.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, when the Buddha is referring to the five clinging aggregates, he refers to that, and especially when he's teaching it, he's recognizing the arising and the passing away of each one of the aggregates. The form aggregate arises and passes away. The feeling aggregates. Perceptions are always changing. Assumptions are always changing. Our thoughts are always changing. But in meditation, when you really get locked onto the breath, even if it's just for a few breaths, what you're recognizing is the arising and the passing away of your breath. And that's not metaphor for impermanence. It's the experience of impermanence. The arising and the passing away. And in that in-breath and the out-breath is the arising and the passing away of all things. And again, that's not metaphorical. If we can understand that, that's even the wrong word. The reason why meditation is ultimately such a powerful tool to use in deepening concentration is that we learn to not be distracted by impermanence. Is that clear? We see clearly, we understand, we have an experience of the arising and passing away of all things. Something that was not often talked about by the Buddha, but he did mention it occasionally, was one of the things that he understood upon his awakening is how he described the underlying energy of all things, and he called these kalapas, K-A-L-A-P-A-S. This, the kalapas, the way he described it, are something that physicists are just now coming to understand. This, these subatomic particles, that Higgs boson thing that I can't describe that well enough. But the Buddha described that. He said that there's an infinite number of these kalapas that come into existence and blink out of existence each and every moment. And that is the underlying substance of everything, including our breath, including ourselves, including our form, our feelings, our perceptions, our mental fabrications, our ongoing consciousness. They're all part of this. Why hold on to it? We had an interesting discussion on retreat about how quantum mechanics is getting to this point where they're struggling with the fact that the effect that the observer has on being what's being observed. They can't take the individual out of the experiment. Well, you can't. The Buddha describes it. These wrong views that we create, that we are holding, create a wrong experience of life, a stressful life. Our thoughts are creating that experience in a direct way. That's not to say that our thoughts have created the universe, but our thoughts have affected the experience that we have. And if our thoughts are rooted in ignorance, we're going to have moments rooted in ignorance. This is a teaching on rebirth all of a sudden. We're going to give birth to moments that are rooted in ignorance. If our thoughts are rooted in the wisdom of the Dhamma, we will give birth to stress-free moments. There's no me in that. So thank you for saying that. The rising and passing away. Tracy, good to see you tonight. Welcome to our Frenchtown Sangha.
Beautiful.
It is nice, isn't it? I'm glad you made it.
Me too. It's taken a while, but we succeeded. and on that note, I'm still taking a while to get into my grounded practice. It's been very sporadic, but I keep trying.
Good.
And, you know, with the benefits that I've kind of held on to over the past year and a half, I feel that, you know, I'm still able to deal better with stressful situations. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'm in a better place.
Oh, yeah. And it's so important to recognize that, the benefits of it. That's part of the right effort. It keeps you going. Well, again, welcome to our song, and I hope you continue to join us here. David, good to see you. How are you?
I'm not too bad, thank you.
Good.
And, ditto. Other comments around the room so far. The routine practice has been very disrupted the last couple of months. But still have been able to catch and observe things during the course of, you know, the work day and other times when I realize I need to just take a breath, literally, figuratively. And so it's still there, but I realize I'm rusty at it and have started to lose something there. And part of what was lost was an anchor. One of the anchors is coming to routine sessions in the Sangha and contemplating and thinking about aspects as laid out by Buddha as you present them. So the opportunity came and went last night for our monthly visit with you in Clinton. I suggest, well, then let's go ahead and go for Frenchtown. So this is our first. It won't be our last, but I realize that we need to do it more regularly, again, to keep us anchored, keep us doing the things that we've started doing, but get back to doing more regularly, and then to keep building on that. And when it doesn't happen, we move on. So Flemington is gone. Clinton, we'll see.
Yeah.
Frenchtown, something new.
Impermanence. Well, I'm glad you both made it tonight. I'm not too sure how long I'll be in Clinton anyway, so I hope you can continue to join us here. The importance of the Sangha can't be overemphasized. Hearing the Dhamma can't be overemphasized. You know, again, it's not just meditation. It really is incorporating the Eightfold Path, which isn't that difficult, but it does take some effort. It does take listening to it. Ananda, who was the Buddha's cousin and was the Buddha's chief attendant for the last 25 years of his life, asked the Buddha one day, and he's expecting some grand mystical answer. He said, "Cuz," I don't think he called him cuz, "what's the most important aspect of your teachings, of your Dhamma?" And he said, "The most important aspect of the Dhamma is the Sangha. You can't do it alone." And that he was telling Ananda that, who was there for every talk the Buddha ever gave. Don't overemphasize. You can't overemphasize the importance of listening to the teachings. And it's interesting to me. For quite a few years of my so-called Buddhist practice, I was part of a tradition that only focuses on meditation, and long extended periods of meditation. And I engaged in that, like I said, for many years. And I literally got more and more confused just meditating. And I didn't understand that until I stopped doing that and developed the Eightfold Path in a way of seeing things clearly. That I entered that situation with a conditioned mind, a mind conditioned in ignorance. And since I had no frame of reference, all of this meditation I was doing was simply a feedback loop towards that ignorance. There was really no way of getting out of it. The Buddha recognized that too. That's why he taught this Eightfold Path. Well, okay. One announcement I wanted to remember, and my well-concentrated mind. There's our Sangha picnic is July 15th, Saturday, with a rain date of Sunday, and it's just over the bridge, about 10 minutes from here. The info and the directions are on the website, so I hope you can join me. Everyone's invited, not just Sangha members, family, friends, kids, pets, all that stuff. In our retreats.
There's no class that day.
There is a class that day.
Oh, there is a class on Saturday morning?
Yep.
John.
What?
That's a lot.
Oh, I'm not. Well, the picnic, I have nothing to do with the picnic, really. I'm just going to
eat.
I'm going to eat and watch my dog have fun. So, yeah, there'll be a class. There'll be a class that day on the 15th. So, that's it. Let's finish with the Buddha's. We always finish here with the Buddha's words on metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And metta means goodwill or loving kindness, and metta is an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path, and it's an ongoing expression of an awakened, fully mature human being. Excuse me. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.